What are we doing here, Rob? We doing a hot pocket, a hot sheet, a hot tart?
It is time for the October hot sheet, Mel. What's new at the Nerve Center?
What's going on at the Nerve Center? Well, I just went to ASAP. That was fun. Drove over to there to the Vegases and did the EMRA 6 and 20 and met a whole bunch of really smart people who are going to be the future of emergency medicine education. You, sir, are not the future. You are the past. I'm just saying. What else is going on? We've got some big updates coming soon to the website. We're going to have inline videos with a written summary. We're going to have faster playback. People have been asking, can you have faster playback on the website? We're going to do that. Whiteboard summaries for C3 coming. Oh, it's so exciting. And actually, C3 is going to go through the MRAP post-production process, which means it's going to be made to sound so spectacular. I just listened to Syncope. Oh, it's so good. It's like a chocolate bundt cake infused bundt cakeian thing. It's so good. And of course, we've got a new app, which we're going to start rolling out very soon, but it should be in its full form by early next year. So it's an exciting time here, Robert.
You mentioned that we're going to have the functionality of increasing the playback speed. I know you listen to a lot of podcasts, listen to a lot of books on your mobile device. Do you listen at fast speed or do you listen at regular
1.5.
speed? 1.5. It doesn't make you feel anxious? Not two.
Two I can't do. And we've had a number of MRAP subscribers say they listen at 2+. I'm like, oh, I can't listen that quick. But I do 1.25 to 1.5 for most things. I find my retention's actually better and I can get through the book faster. Although I should say there's a book that a friend of mine told me about called Seven Eves. It's 400 hours long, Rob. And I still haven't finished it. And you told me about that book a year ago.
It's worth it, though. It'll be worth it when you finish it.
Oh, my gosh. It's just a marathon.
But it's so good. All right. Let's go to some letters. We've gotten some feedback on a recent segment on the bounce backs and the use of the term mid-level providers, and got the suggestion that this term is out of date. And instead of referring to nurse practitioners and PAs as mid-level providers, to use the term advanced practice clinicians, or APCs, or APPs, as we call them at our hospital. And we floated this out to some of our PA and nurse practitioner friends, and really a mixed reaction. Some say, mid-level's fine, it's what I call myself. And others say, that's passé, stop saying that immediately.
So I think what we're going to do as an official MRAP thing is use the term advanced practice clinician, because that seems to be sort of the official nomenclature. You're not likely to upset anybody by using that naming convention. And I think that language is important and it changes over time. And these are our friends, our colleagues, we're all working together. So we want to use the right term. So I think we're going to use advanced practice clinicians. That's what they say. That's what we do.
APC. Before we get to the main content, challenge coins. First up is Dr. Mo Gaber. I've known Mo for over 2 years now, and of his many great attributes, his dedication to pediatric care in the ED. It's incredible. Mo ensures every measure is taken so that kids aren't afraid of hospitals, doctors, or nurses. This means going as far as to select staff to assist with procedures and introducing them. His communication with both parents and children is appropriate and tailored to address any concerns. Mo ensures every measure is taken so that they're not afraid of hospitals, doctors, or nurses. No child should ever be afraid of a doctor. He says it every time. No child should ever be afraid of a doctor, a nurse, or a hospital. Keep it up, Mo. Well done.
And thanks to Dr. Rotella for suggesting Dr. Mo for a coin.
Next up is Dr. Bob Harwood. He was in the very first class of residents, 1979, at Advocate Christ Medical Center. And since then, he has been Educator of the Year, too many times to count, Program Director of the Year, actively involved in research and every other core component of our department. But accolades mean little to Bob. He's never left a shift on time in over 36 years because he never has enough time to teach a resident something. I don't believe he's ever said no to the question in our department that started out, I need volunteers to help with, etc. Despite overcrowding, crazy workloads, and crappy resources, his glass is always half full. I've met countless emergency physicians in my 28 years, none more deserving than Robert C. Harwood. Above and beyond, that is Bob Harwood.
And so thanks to Dr. Michael Lambert for suggesting Bob Harwood, Dr. Harwood, challenge coin in the mail.
On to the education topic of the day, the naloxone auto-injector, or I'd say self-administered naloxone, or maybe somebody at your house or on the street's going to administer naloxone. We know that there is an opioid overdose epidemic. We know that a huge chunk of that comes from prescription meds, and people die from opioid ODs every day. But prescribing naloxone from the ED hasn't caught on as something we automatically do.
Unlike, say, I don't know, the EpiPen and anaphylaxis, we have patients coming in with an allergic reaction. We fix that allergic reaction, and then we send them home with an EpiPen, Rob, which is the treatment for their allergic reaction, which can kill them very quickly. But do we do that with naloxone? No, these patients who have overdosed are very likely to overdose again. But do we give them an injector to stop them dying? Do we do that, Robert?
We don't. Well, maybe some people do, but this is a topic I know little about. So we went all the way to the Canada to find some experts, ED physicians, two ED physicians, Aaron Orkin, he's also a public health specialist, and Michelle Clayman, she is an addiction medicine consultant.
Here's Michelle answering the question I want to know most. When should I think about giving a patient one of these prescription auto-injectors? I need to know the situation.
Besides the patients who present to the eMERGE with overdose and survive and are discharged, we think there are three other groups. So one, people who are prescribed high-dose opioids, and this could be something we either notice or a prescription that we're writing. We also believe that anybody who abuses opioids, so presents to the emergency department maybe with a complication from their opioid use, they should know about naloxone and they should be provided with the kit and with the training. We also believe that people who abuse alcohol or benzos or psychotropics in addition to opioids or are at very high risk. And these patients come into the eMERGE all the time, so we're really missing an opportunity here to save lives.
What's the basic idea with this? Is it something that they carry on their hip and a bracelet that if I'm passed out, inject this in me, or is it going to the family?
So it's really going to anybody who uses opioids or maybe a potential bystander to somebody who has a near fatal overdose. That could be family, that could be friends, that could be people who use with other people. We know that when people do abuse opioids, they usually use in groups. Right now, naloxone distribution is mostly happening in public health and harm reduction programs. So these programs are giving it out to anybody who really wants a kit. The basic idea is to target anyone at risk for overdose and anyone likely to be a bystander to overdose. So in the eMERGE, we do see this population who has the highest risk from fatal overdose, so people who just survived a near fatal overdose. So maybe we should be training people and distributing naloxone through the eMERGE and taking it from the harm reduction setting into more of a medical setting.
When we're in the emergency department, we're thinking on the micro level. And that's what we've been talking about. We've been talking about the patient in front of us. But what's happening with this on the macro level or the public health level?
To understand this, you really need to bridge that micro level concern about your individual patient with the macro level benefits of community training and first aid. We know that if you train one person to use an AED, that's not going to help your community. But if you put AEDs all over the community and train thousands of people to use them, we've seen cardiac arrest survival really improve. This is the same philosophy with anaphylaxis. We know that if you give one kid an EpiPen, that's good for that kid. But schools, and if most of us have set foot in elementary school, you'll see that they put up everyone's EpiPen on the wall, and they know that it's safe to use one kid's EpiPen on another kid. Public health is using that approach around naloxone distribution. They're saying that overdose is a more common cause of death than motor vehicle collisions, and we need two things to really improve survival. We need access to a drug that we know might help people improve their respiratory status, maybe still be alive when EMS gets there, maybe be breathing when they get to the emergency department. As an eMERGE doc, I really like it when my patients are breathing when they arrive. And we also need first aid. We need people to understand a chain of survival, so they need to call 911, administer some standard basic life support maneuvers, and access care. And that's exactly what public health is doing. There's over 200 programs in North America alone distributing naloxone. There's many more worldwide. Scotland has a national program, as does Wales. The estimates are that about 80,000 people in North America have been trained and equipped with naloxone and the training to use it. So it's first aid plus naloxone. It goes bigger than that too. The World Health Organization and the CDC are calling for much greater access to naloxone all over the world. American and international emergency medicine and toxicology societies have put their support behind this. ASEP is supporting this in principle and developing a specific policy statement on who should get this, how training should occur. But also police departments and fire departments are carrying naloxone. Cops are carrying this in their cars or on their hips. And that has a big effect on the public health level in terms of the first moments when people who are obtunded or sedated because of overdose are managed. So the next piece is that industry is jumping in. As soon as you've got a market for naloxone, there's an opportunity for better devices because most of these kits right now are really cumbersome. They consist of vials or syringes and atomizers if the intranasal route is going to be used. So industry is jumping in with nifty devices. I think this is important because patients deserve better. A cumbersome kit is hard to use, won't be used well. And if kids who are allergic to shellfish or peanut butter deserve a nice talking device or an EpiPen that is safe to use, safe to carry, easy to recognize, I don't see why people who have a different risk don't deserve the same sort of quality of device. Then we have some evidence. The systematic reviews shows that about 10% of trained people use the intervention. There's very little evidence of harm, and training fidelity isn't that great, so people don't do exactly what they're taught, but it's no worse than anaphylaxis. We've got studies on EpiPens that show that 7 to 12% of people, when they're stopped, who are supposed to know how to use their EpiPen can actually do it, and that doesn't stop us from prescribing EpiPens, so I don't know why we would expect better in this population. The other thing is that when you say 10% of trained people use the intervention, that's huge. If you train a person to use an AED or an EpiPen, the likelihood that they're going to use that first aid training in their first year or so after being taught it is minuscule. People who are at risk of overdose, especially illicit drug users, are around other people who are overdosing on an almost routine basis. 10% is unbelievable. And if you want to think about training someone in first aid and actually having an impact on survival, this is the place to do it. You train lay people to respond appropriately to overdose, and they're going to use that skill right away. I don't see an excuse for not providing that training. Lastly, we have a big study in Massachusetts that shows that communities with higher enrollment in naloxone distribution programs have fewer overdose-related deaths than those communities that have less enrollment in those programs.
Now, this sounds like a great idea, but I wonder a couple things. One is if this saves lives, and if we're sending patients home with this, I guess it's really going to be instructions for the family member or another person. So for the Epi auto-injector, I give explicit instructions on exactly how to use it, when to use it. So is that going to be a similar thing when you're talking with the family, or you know, maybe there's not family, but how is that instruction or that information transmitted?
So I think it should be transmitted in exactly the same way as you're describing with anaphylaxis. We have some additional benefits here in that the basic approach of BLS, either taught through a basic BLS video or through a ultra short training intervention, that works in this setting. You're looking for a generalized approach to somebody with an altered level of consciousness, plus the ability to administer naloxone, and of course, access 911 or access emergency services. And there are lots of ways to provide that training, either on video, through handout materials, and through a conversation at the bedside. I believe eMERGE docs are expert at this. They do this with their discharge instructions routinely. The only other piece is that it's not always just family members, especially with IV drug users and people who are abusing prescription drugs. There is a large community of people who use together. And training somebody who just survived overdose to use this intervention is also appropriate because they are likely going to be around other people who use. And so emergency doctors might have to shift to saying, you know, if I save a life, it doesn't necessarily have to be the life right in front of me. Just because I provide an intervention that might save my patient's friend's life, that's also appropriate. I would say we're doing that around anaphylaxis all the time. And so it does also make sense to train the patient because they might save another life.
What's in this kit and what does it cost? Is it covered by insurance?
So most kits have one or two doses of naloxone in them at a dose of 0.4 milligrams. They either have a syringe with a needle or an atomizer, and some of the kits even come with pre-filled syringes. The kits from existing public health and harm reduction programs are free to the user. The only FDA-approved device right now is Evzio, but with naloxone rather than epinephrine. It's essentially a talking auto-injector. There are many more devices coming down the pipeline, but Evzio could cost as much as $500, so that's quite pricey.
Well, I think we've heard this story before, Rob. You think that's pricey? Well, the price just recently went up not to $600 from $500, but to $3,000 in some places. This smells a little bit like the EpiPen-ish story.
It does. It does. You know, there's actually a spray, which I was looking it up right before we recorded this, which is cheaper, just over $100, at least at the time we're recording this, although it could go up to $5,000 by the time we release it in a couple hours.
And the insurance questions are still huge.
Public health units are already running these programs, and they're handing out the training and the kits for free to anyone who wants them, no questions asked. So whether or not you have a health problem or want to talk about how you use drugs or your family members use drugs, you can just show up to many of these public health units, ask for the training, ask for the kit, and you will be provided with it for free. And so ED docs should know about this. That's already ready for referral today, that if your patient survives overdose and your local health unit is running a naloxone distribution program, sending your patient over there to get the training, get the kit, get their family and friends to come with them for the kit, that's already for prime time and entirely operationalized by public health.
I think that there's another side of this. Why should the onus be on us when you're abusing all these medications?
So I think we need to move past some of this stigma. From my perspective, this is a pre-hospital resuscitative emergency, and emergency doctors don't like dead people, and they don't like dying people. I like living people. And on the one hand, we have kids who are allergic to peanuts and shellfish, and they have what I would call a pre-hospital resuscitative emergency, and we say we don't like it when kids die. So we give the community and the patients and their family members the whole infrastructure to make sure that they don't die, irrespective of the fact that they're allergic to peanuts and shellfish. On the other hand, we have people who have a different disease. That disease is addiction. And one of the risks of that sort of addiction or that sort of misuse is that they may have a different type of pre-hospital resuscitative emergency. And I don't like dead people. As an emergency doctor, I would prefer if people don't come in dying during my shift, even though I'm ready to handle it when it happens. And so I have a different intervention that I can provide for this group. To me, it's not about judging and saying that this group in some way or another deserves to have an overdose and not survive it because as a society, we think it's inappropriate that they have that disease in the first place. From my perspective, they have addiction, which is a disease, just like anaphylaxis is a disease. And one of the side effects or one of the downstream effects of that disease is a pre-hospital resuscitative emergency. And the management, the appropriate way to manage a pre-hospital resuscitative emergency is not just to have paramedics and emergency doctors that know what to do, but it's also to have good BLS systems and good bystander systems. This is predictable. We know that they're going to have this sort of event. And just saying that it's because they have a disease called addiction that we think is their own fault is not an appropriate reason for them to not have the bystander care, just like the kid who's allergic to peanuts or shellfish.
I think that the stigma issue, it's so important because, you know, the kid who's allergic to peanuts, it's kind of, oh, it's not their fault. And look at that cute little kid who's having this allergic reaction. We need to save them. But at the end of the day, dead is dead.
And disease is disease. And as eMERGE docs, as a healthcare system, we need to say we're not part of this war on drugs. We're part of the community that treats disease, identifies it, and manages it. And addiction is just a disease.
All right, Michelle and Aaron, bottom line.
Naloxone distribution and overdose education is not common practice in most EDs, and it's not common practice in primary care or most outpatient clinics. But overdose is killing people at a staggering rate, and this is already standard of care in public health. So each of us needs to ask ourselves this. If it's absolute standard of care to give people who survive anaphylaxis the drugs and the skills to start pre-hospital treatment and access care, why do I discharge overdose patients without the same tools? The presence of these programs outside the ED is also important for ED docs to know about whether or not you're going to start prescribing it yourself. In many jurisdictions, the solution for the committed eMERGE doc might be to refer the patient to an existing program or a harm reduction clinic in their neighborhood, or to get the naloxone and the training locally. This is probably already an appropriate referral for somebody who survives overdose and is available all over North America. The last piece of the bottom line is that ED docs are going to start to meet overdose patients in their department who got naloxone from a bystander before EMS was called. They need to know how this happened. They need to know to ask about it in their history. They need to know who gave them naloxone and how to support and encourage that bystander who really did the right thing and maybe saved a life. It's kind of like meeting the school principal who gave the EpiPen or the hockey referee who used the AED. We need to congratulate these people rather than giving them furrowed brows or suspicious questions.